Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann. Check this out. Late last fall, an editor from the publication Organic Insider asked our Secretary of the USDA, Sonny Perdue, about some concerns that organic farmers have had about competing with large hydroponic production. See, new rules allow food to be labeled as organic even though the food isn't grown in soil. In his response, Perdue brought up changes in the meat industry and cell-based technology. He explained, it shouldn't be considered competitive, just like the meat industry, he said. We've got new technology with stem cell protein growth there. While some people may be anxious about taking their markets, shouldn't we in the United States be about how we can grow and feed people more efficiently and more effectively? These techniques need to be embraced, not kept out. Well, I guess maybe he has a point. But that's not what he was asked. And hey, who would have thunk there's actually a politician in Trump's cabinet? And what kind of call to action is that? You see, there's been a lot of stirring in the world of differentiated food about the role of the USDA in this process of classifying and certifying the standards moving forward. This is the same USDA under Trump and Perdue, by the way, that withdrew animal welfare regulation and organic certification back in May of 2018. Despite organics being originally crafted to be food grown using the best practices which mirror natural order, that's not how things have shaken out in recent years. We were lucky to have Fred Kirschemann on one of the first episodes of Sourcing Matters. He's a founding father of U.S. organics. Kirschemann was one of the influential folks who penned the original standards. Fred explained to our audience that despite being a consensus of all participants on the oversight board to include soil as a baseline for USDA organic certification, when the federal lawyers got involved, everything got binary, and everything got whittled down to yes, no answers. So that meant that all questions to be determined if something was organic had to be formatted as such. The process became, if it's this type of input or that, is it a yes or is it a no? So last year, when the National Organic Standards Board decided to include hydroponics in organically certified, it didn't surprise Kirschemann one bit. And there you go. That's the actual answer to the question the Organic Insider publication posed to Secretary Perdue. Even if Secretary Perdue is correct, even if we should include lab meat, water-grown crops, or new synthetics deemed to be not as bad as other synthetics, I'm not sure we have a luxury to fight that battle anymore. It's not about the impact the food has on you, the consumer, anymore. At 7.6 billion folks around the globe, all looking to eat, we've got bigger fish to fry, and that includes both genetically engineered and open codfish. What becomes clear, our impact on the planet, from the way we feed ourselves, will ultimately be our demise or our savior. Now, returning back to the role of the USDA for a moment, there's 100,000 folks working for this behemoth. The vast majority are fantastic people who know they're doing the right thing. So maybe it comes down to focus. 2017, organics accounted for only 5.5% of U.S. food sold. Demand has been on the rise, but it's still but a rounding error for the USDA. Maybe, like in other industries, like with animal welfare regulations, we need other entities to break new ground, to charge ahead, to draft a new plan for which the federal government will follow. Despite Secretary Perdue's interest in the cool new tech, I don't think anyone looks to the USDA to be bleeding edge, innovative, or nimble juggernaut that's going to adapt to feeding an increasingly flat, hot, and crowded planet. Ultimately, this is going to fall on us and the food choices we make. The good news is we have some amazing folks fighting for soil health, for animal welfare, and for workers' rights. They reside outside of the federal government. Today, we're lucky to be welcoming one of those folks leading the charge. Today, we welcome Elizabeth Whitlow, the Executive Director of the Regenerative Organic Association. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hey, Aaron. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. I love having you on. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. My first question to you is coconut settled down and ready to go?
Coconut is oblivious to the fact that there is a really important podcast happening here in the home office. So, yeah, she's just outside sleeping. Okay. Not outside. Outside my office.
Okay, very good. Coconut being your dog, of course, yes.
Yes, yes.
All right, so I described...
Thanks for asking.
Of course, of course. So I described some big shoes to fill there. But it seems that you've got a good plan and some wonderful backing. Can you tell us a bit more about what you're up to with the Regenerative Organic Association?
Yep, I'd love to. And I just want to say first off how much I enjoy your show. I've been listening to it a lot in the last few months, and I still am just wondering how you have the time to do all the research you do to get all the great guests you get on your show. And I'm really proud that you asked me to be on your show. So thank you.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you. So thank you for taking the time.
Yeah. So as far as the Regenerative Organic Alliance, which I'm now the executive director, we are overseeing and implementing this new certification, and that's called the Regenerative Organic Certification. And the founders of the Regenerative Organic Alliance are people from Patagonia, and Dr. Bronner's really the ones who had the vision here, along with Rodale, working closely with Rodale to develop the plan for the Regenerative Organic Alliance. And it's come together really quickly, as you noted. It's really only been a year and a half or so since they first gathered around the table for a couple days up at the Rodale Institute. And many of the leaders and activists in this movement were just gathering and working out their vision for the future of agriculture. They saw the writing on the wall. They saw where things were going. And there was a lot of concern at that time about that pending hydroponic vote. And so they wanted to really put a stake in the ground, as it were, to really try and help keep the organic program strong and give an alternative to that program that went into other areas as well. So I believe you were just looking on our website, and really this program is all based on finding a program of certification that is a high bar certification that encompasses the three pillars, soil health, animal welfare, and social fairness. And so that's kind of the evolution of it, the big broad stroke pictures, and we can get into more detail on that as we talk in the next hour.
Yeah, let's get into that a bit. If you described the high bar standards relating to soil health, animal welfare, and social fairness. How did you settle on those buckets to be your high bar standard to enhance organic?
Well, I wish I could say I was there at the table with these people, but I've only been in this position a few months, so I can pull from all the information that we have here. And really, I would say the first and foremost is the focus on soil health. And this was stemming from the concerns around that hydroponic vote and a recognition that there needed to be more regenerative practices incorporated into the organic rule and or on organic by organic farmers. And so this, you know, initially with Rodale leading the charge, they point out the different regenerative practices that have so many benefits in building healthy soil. It was Robert Rodale who first coined that term regenerative organic long ago, and he described it as a holistic approach to farming that encourages continuous innovation and improvement of environmental, social, and economic measures. And so really the primary focus on the soil pillar was to build soil health and recognizing that healthy soil equals healthy food equals healthy people. And so, you know, this is intrinsically linked to the total health of our food system and also seeing the benefits of the carbon sequestration and the water retention and the many, many benefits that come from building healthy soil, as many of your guests have talked about, in fact, David Montgomery, Gabe Brown, and many others on your show, Fred Kirschman being one of the first guests on your show. And they've all recognized that this is really critical to an organic system, is building a healthy soil, and you know, that this soil is teeming with life. It's full of bacteria and fungi and protozoa and nematodes and all kinds of creatures that play a really important role in plant health. And so that that was really the main focus for that soil pillar. And the animal welfare, this one also came about, I think, you know, largely as a result of what was going on in the federal rule on organics. Many consumers have these ideas of animals, ruminants out grazing on pasture and hens foraging out there in the yard and eating bugs and grubs out in the green grass. But really what was happening was that that many of these provisions weren't being upheld in some of the large kind of confinement animal feeding operations that are still happening in some of the organic sector. And in fact, probably more so since the Trump administration rolled back the animal welfare provisions that many people in the industry had been working on for years and trying to implement. So animal welfare became another really important pillar for the Regenerative Organic Alliance. And then finally, I think one that is often overlooked here in the global north or in developed world is that social fairness component. And so it's much more common and easy to find fair trade certified type products when you're buying from developing world, like coffee or chocolate or countries where there's really egregious violations, abhorrent conditions and slave and child labor and many things that have been addressed through that social fairness movement that has exploded globally. And I feel like it's really just coming here to the United States more and more. And we're finding more programs that address this as we look at migrant labor and the conditions under which people are working here. We're also looking at fairness for farmers who work all day long and still can't even calculate a fair trade or fair wage for themselves or a living wage for themselves. So those are our three pillars, and we've all got plenty of complexity and lots of different things to explore in each of these pillars as we kind of move into the next phase of this project.
And I understand that the program is set up to be higher bar, as you define it, or even aspirational, but you're allowing for folks to partake in a silver, gold, or I guess it would be bronze, silver, gold, maybe platinum. There's a few different categories you have as offerings to coax individuals into this. Can you describe how you came to that conclusion and how you've seen folks partake in this thus far?
Yeah, there's no platinum, not yet, but right now we have bronze, silver, and gold. And so the bronze is basically kind of initiating that entry into that journey to regenerative. And there's different provisions in our standard, which is available on our website. You can look at the full standard there, and it describes the requirements for each of these different levels, whether it's bronze, silver, or gold. And the idea is just to help really encourage that continuous improvement concept that many felt were lacking in the NOP, that, you know, once you get there and you're certified organic, that you don't have to keep improving. And so with this, we're really trying to move people along the gradient. So they enter into that bronze certification and they move up, and the next would be silver, and that's when you can actually use the label on pack. And then gold, of course, is really high bar, and we don't expect to see a lot of producers meeting that gold standard, but it's meant to be this North Star and really just to keep moving along in that direction and really implementing as many of these practices as you can.
A statement on your site says the goal of regenerative organic agriculture is to offer practical solutions to the world's biggest social and ecological challenges. You say that we're beyond the point of sustainability and we need to regenerate the soils and land that supports us, the animals that nourish us, and the farmers and workers that feed us. This is a path forward and you can be part of the solution. Now, that's a much better and stronger call to action than when we heard from Secretary Perdue a few moments ago.
I will give you that.
How has that call to action been received by the different stakeholders thus far?
Kind of unbelievable. I have to say, since I started in this position, I feel like people laugh, but I feel like I've been on a dead run since September. And I just every day I get up and I there is so much to do. There's all this interest, people wanting to work with us, partner with us. Can we be in the pilot project? How do we be first in line when you're ready to do certification? So there's a tremendous amount of interest and support here domestically. I just came back from BioFac in Nuremberg, Germany, which is, I think you're familiar with the BioFac trade show. Really big, I think the largest in the world, natural foods trade show, where there was a lot of interest as well from the Europeans. And I think it's quite a sophisticated audience, and they're definitely ready for this and really demonstrating a lot of interest. In fact, I have several invitations to go back and speak to other groups coming up this summer. And I think we'll make some really positive inroads there in Europe as well. And as you may know, America here, we have the highest demand in the world for organic products, but Europe, Germany in particular, is right behind us. And so I think it's really good potential for us to keep growing the movement.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they've been able, through Biologic, they've been able to preserve that connection to soil, and they haven't let other things creep into it if their administrations change, and allowing, if we were talking about animal welfare practices specifically, they're usually much more progressive in their approach. And it seems that they've been very effective, in my experience, in many of the, especially the northern European countries, in explaining that and engaging the consumer in that conversation. Have you taken any pages out of their book on how to get consumers to be your best advocates?
Yeah, no, we need to. It's there's a lot of need here, and so far, being a startup and being the sole employee working with various teams from all the different entities who are involved and supporting us, that one is definitely high on the list, and getting an education program together both for farmers and for consumers. And so I agree with you that taking a page out of their playbook, or a few pages, would be really helpful. And, you know, it's just you can't change an entire nation. As you know, here in America, consumers, it's quite a different approach to consumption here. I think people really are after cheap food in many cases, and they even feel entitled to cheap food. And so there's not as much awareness around it as you would find in Europe.
It is interesting because, as you had mentioned before, between sweets, savories, chocolate, coffee, beer, wine, there are certain food categories where the consumer has elevated those requests and demands. But when it comes to the center of the plate, we're a bit oblivious to what really those values of food are. So it seems, from what you're describing here and what you've set up, the Regenerative Organic Alliance and the certifications associated to that are allowing for that same consumer to then parlay their interest into much larger food categories.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right as far as just the center of the plate and looking at where Americans, the idea around the cost of protein, for example. Many people feel entitled to 10-cent eggs. A chicken egg should cost about $1. It's actually it's a decent protein serving right there. One or two eggs is really all you need, right?
Yeah.
And so it's not that much, but it is when you start asking consumers here to spend $12 on a dozen eggs. And, because they're used to going to the store and getting these 99-cent dozen eggs, or this same with the chicken. And yet it's because we aren't internalizing the cost of producing meat and eggs like that.
Yeah.
And what it costs downstream for all those communities who have to live in those areas where their water is being polluted and where the air is and soil isn't being replenished, or the air is dirty and the workers aren't well. And there's all these other consequences to that kind of food. So definitely that is a rude awakening probably in store for us here in America, because this cheap food can't go on forever. at some point we're going to have to start to build in those, the true cost of food. And in this case, you know, it's looking at consumers, aimed towards consumers who are willing to pay a premium for a product that really represents the values that they want to uphold. And that is, you know, again, going back to the soil health, the animal welfare, and that social wellness, social fairness.
Yeah, and it's interesting because what we're talking about with these elevated standards in production, yes, they have huge impact on environmental issues, as we've talked about, on social fairness and on animal welfare. But when we're talking about when you're consuming, maybe instead of the dollar per egg, but you're actually eating a 12 egg omelet in mass consumption for $4, it's because that cheap food has allowed us to then proliferate this huge volumes of unhealthy food. And that's maybe why we've got these astronomical healthcare problems in our country, where 45% of our population will be obese by 2025. Have you seen interest from your stakeholders to make that correlation, that connection to food as preventative healthcare?
Gosh, you know, you've had a couple guests on your show who I love their work, Daphne Miller and Marianne Nessel, and they talk a lot about that too. And at this point, we're probably not quite there yet as far as making that connection, although there's definitely work being done to assess the bionutrient availability of food grown in healthy soil, because we are certainly clearly a nation of you know, overfed, undernourished people who, you know, people are not getting the nutrients they need in their food, but yet they're getting too much food, so they're overweight, creating all these other health problems, as we know, the obesity and diabetes and healthcare costs. But at this point, no, not yet.
Well, only so many things you can tackle at once, right? As a one-person team, I get it. That's
exactly. We're growing. We do have I do have help with communications right now, and we have. I want to just call out to the teams of support that I have. Just you know, we're partnered up with NSF to roll out the certification. So they've got a team of people, really talented people who have rolled out a number of different standards. And they're the program manager and helping develop all these tools. For example, our accreditation guidelines for certification bodies and the certification, the participant handbook that we just published recently on our website under the resources page. And in there are links to other supporting documents that get into the nitty gritty of how this certification is going to look and how it's going to work. And also, as we move into this next stage of our pilot, they're going to help with onboarding the certification bodies, and we've got an auditor training set up in all the different pillars and an overview, and then a test for auditors, and they will go out and shadow the auditors. I'll accompany as many as I can, but there's a lot of need to be in a lot of places right now. So then I've got that team. I've also got amazing support from our founders, from Patagonia Provisions, and Bronner's, and Rodale. And so all of those entities are providing me with resources as in certain ways and when I need support. So that's really helped make this possible. And soon we will begin to grow, and we will begin to have staff. And I think one of the first ones will be in development and working to develop our education programs for consumers, education programs for farmers, and a standards person or department to help as we navigate the certification decisions that are going to start coming down the pipe here in the coming months.
Yeah, only so many hours in the day, right? And somebody's got to be home to let coconut out once in a while.
I love that coconut made it to the podcast. All my friends are going to think this is hilarious.
Be proud. That's right.
They will be proud.
A little more on your bio. Elizabeth Whitlow has dedicated her career in regenerative agriculture to further the impact of high bar certifications. In her most recent role as Earth Claims Director of Certification, she oversaw a team working to provide private third-party verification services for animal welfare, grass-fed claims, antibiotic-free, and customized audits to support specific marketing claims. Prior to Earth Claims, Elizabeth was a fellow at the Leadership for Sustainable Future. Elizabeth has also spent 16 years with the California Certified Organic Farmers in roles ranging from reviewer, senior inspector, and livestock specialist in inspection of operations manager. So let me ask this. You've lived this. You've been involved in this for a long time. I can see why you've taken the position as the executive director of this new opportunity. But what got you into it in the first place?
You did your research, I guess, there, didn't you? So, yes, I did have many years working in certification, more in the trenches and working with farmers and producers and really understanding kind of where that rubber meets the road when it comes to verifying compliance in the field and what's real, what works. So it's been many, many rewarding years of working in this field. I came to it oddly through, I had finished college. I graduated with a degree in German and English from Georgia State University and was waiting for a Peace Corps assignment. And I decided to just look for something else to do, to get out of Atlanta for a bit. And I got this internship in the Ozarks at David Orr's Meadow Creek project. And this was back in the early 90s. And I'm not sure if you know David Orr, but this Meadow Creek project was a center for sustainable agriculture and renewable energy. And there I was introduced to the work of Hunter and Amory Lovins, Wes Jackson, and Fred Tiersteman. And so it's really fascinating and beautiful to me that it kind of all comes around like this here, especially with, I'll tell you a little bit more about Wes Jackson here in a minute. But I was introduced to agriculture, and I didn't really have a good grasp on what it took to grow food at the time. And I just learned then that the average mile that food traveled to get to my plate was 1600 miles. And so, you know, I could see, being a pretty rabid environmentalist, that there was much more power in channeling that environmental activism into food. Because as you know, we get to vote with our fork, and we get to make change through selecting foods that can really support a local thriving community and food system. And so I threw myself into this, and I never looked back. I headed west, and I got out to Washington State, where I attended graduate school and focused on agroecology, and got involved in the specialty coffee industry for a few years. And right in the beginning of like the shade grown fair trade organic evolution in coffee and specialty coffee. So that was a pretty neat kind of side path that led me to the Bay Area, where I started working for CCUF in 2001.
It's always an interesting road, right? I mean, it's never a straight path.
Never, yeah. Never. And let's hope not. Yeah, I had lots of fun detours and adventures along the way. But one of those was to my first Prairie Fest at the Land Institute, where I met Wes Jackson. And I just remember seeing all the work that they were doing there with the perennial grains, and just being really struck by the power of this concept of like restoring this native prairie and finding a way to breed and make this grain something that could be viable for feeding people and doesn't need to be replanted, cultivated, tilled, and replanted, seeds purchased, do over every year like we do for wheat and other grains in this country. And so also seeing that there wasn't, you know, it's been 20 years or no more, 30 years. And there's still, you know, it's just been in the last few years that suddenly Kernza, and much of it, I think, came from Patagonia Provisions, where Birgit, the director there, I don't know if you know Birgit, but you should, she went to visit Wes Jackson, and she wanted to see like if he had enough crop to work with there for them to do something. And he brought her down into the seed bank, and she apparently looked around and was just like, yes, Mr. Jackson, I think you've got enough for us to do something with. And they started working on developing long root ale, which is a really beautiful project of a beer that that you should come out and enjoy with us sometime out here on the West Coast, because I don't think it's distributed too widely. But yeah, so they're taking that Kernza from West Jackson and working with a brewer and turning it into a really fine microbrew.
Well, I will take you up on that offer at some point too, no doubt about that. We did hear a little bit about it from Ryland Englehart, who from Kiss the Ground, he had mentioned Long Roots Patagonia Ale. And it is interesting to me, because I think a lot of our listeners will be familiar with Patagonia, obviously, for their background, their interest, and their commitment to the planet. In fact, it's a bit of their lifestyle call to action is around their commitment to the planet, from the $10 million they're going to put back to the planet that they receive for tax credits, to even the marketing approach that they used in saying, stop buying our jackets.
Yeah,
I love it. It was great. They sold 5 more jackets per every consumer because of that. But they really seem to know their engaged consumer that are making these lifestyle choices around the products they've selected. They've also introduced Patagonia Provision. So it really seems to be a very progressive organization that has been leading the way around commitments towards a holistic perspective. How has it been for you to work with their organization, being right in their backyard as well?
Unbelievable. I have to say, like, half the time I'm talking to those folks, I have goosebumps. Like, there's so much commitment there. It really kind of astounds me. And they truly live it. If you ever go to visit their headquarters down in Ventura, you see as you walk up, there is a daycare that surrounds the reception, and children are running and playing and laughing or crying, and their parents are down there visiting them away from their desks for a minute, or going to grab their child to go eat at that employee cafe that is right there, this bustling site full of organically sourced, I'm sure, and many probably regenerative organically sourced products. There's surfboards stacked up here, bikes there, solar panels, and it's just like the commitment is really clear. And yes, they also show it with their support of so many different organizations doing this good work. And it's been an honor of a lifetime to join up, link arms with them, and be on mission for Yvon Chouinard. And really, I think Yvon Chouinard, if you've seen Unbroken Ground, that documentary, it's really great. And it gives you some insight into how this movement came to be. He saw that in 40 years of working to try and change the landscape around textiles and source 100% organic cotton and do all the work they do to be really good environmental citizens, that they weren't going to have as much impact as they might have in food. And so that's, I think this is how Provisions was born. And there's a big future for Provisions. And they're going to, I'm going to be working very closely with them. They're further north. They're up here in Sausalito, and I'm just north of them up in Sonoma County. So we're in the North Bay. And then Patagonia is based down in more in Southern California. And then Bronner's also is equally amazing in their commitment and their support of all things righteous. And if you've ever met David Bronner, you will know, like, the whole family is really engaged in this fight and doing good work. They do disaster relief. They throw themselves at so many things. They were really instrumental in the hemp, the recent victory with the hemp in farming with the USDA and the Farm Bill. And then, of course, are, you know, equally supportive partners here of this movement, and will be sourcing, you know, they're working with their supply chains, and several of them, 2 of them are in our pilot project. They've got Surrender Palm, which is palm production in Ghana. And then we've got coconuts also that will be coming in from Sri Lanka. And so working with their team, they're really knowledgeable people who've been building up these incredible relationships, really healthy relationships in their supply chain in areas where we can't even imagine the trials and tribulations of people in these regions. So they're a remarkable company as well.
I think of Bronner's as being just one of those staple companies that has, for since the beginning, doing it the right way because it's the right thing to do. And well before it became hip or exciting for the consumer to be involved, but they were doing it for environmental purposes for their treatment of the people. And in fact, when you're describing that relationship that you have with Patagonia and what you've witnessed there, it reminded me of that Richard Branson quote, which is, you know, you train your folks well enough that they can leave and you treat them well enough that they're going to stay.
Nice. Yeah.
Hey, so Elizabeth, I read a great quote statement that struck a nerve with me. You'd stated that I'm passionate about making change in the world by focusing my energy on supporting and developing more sustainable food systems that honor the hard work of ecologically minded farmers. As a concerned and engaged taxpaying citizen, I advocate for the elimination of detrimental government programs and policies that support industrialized farming systems. We need to stop subsidizing agricultural operations that harm the environment, the health of the workers, our neighbors, and consumers. So my question for you related to that is, are we going to be able to do this in a timely fashion?
You have to remain hopeful and you have to be optimistic. I mean, the only alternative would be to get up and be bummed and go do something that doesn't matter. So I have to think that there's hope. And, you know, like if you look, so that statement was a while ago. And actually it was when I had seen this 50-year farm bill idea that Wes Jackson was at EcoFarm one year. This was a few years ago that Wes Jackson and Fred Kirschenman put forth this concept. Like, why do we keep writing these short-term farm bills? And really, if you look at what dictates how we farm here in this country, it's that massive farm bill that is $950 billion. And of that, much of it goes to the SNAP program, but a lot of it goes to crop insurance that really just perpetuates the system, this really broken system that I think we need to get away from. And there's just so many special interests in there that it's really hard pull it out of there, but definitely here in this country, you know, we need to focus more on that. And I look at some of the, you know, these newer legislators who have come in and this Green New Deal, and kind of it gives me a lot of hope that in this next election cycle that we're going to make some more progress, and we'll keep making progress, and you know, people keep recognizing the cost of climate change, despite the fact that Trump doesn't think it exists or there's these climate naysayers. Climate-related disasters are costing us billions and billions of dollars. And I'm quite, you know, personally, I've been very close to that. I live 4 miles from where the Tubbs fire leapt over 8 lanes of highway and decimated an entire neighborhood in that first big wildfire that kind of shocked the nation, I think, and then it rippled up and down California. But that was last year. You know, and then we had this year. Well, I guess 2 years ago, and then we had this last year, and right now we've got major flooding going on as we speak. There's climate related disasters happening everywhere, and the sooner we recognize it and start putting money into something like regenerative agriculture that can build a healthy soil, that can sequester carbon, and actually reverse these effects, that can absorb 8 times more rain, or whatever that statistic is, I think it's what is it, 0.5 inches of rain for a kind of a depleted soil, and up to 8 inches or more. That's from your guest, Gabe Brown.
Yeah.
How much more water can be absorbed when you treat soil as a living soil and it becomes this sponge that can absorb the water and you don't have these same effects. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's this collective effort, all of us, and there are many working towards this now. And I think there's also a lot of interest from kind of the investment, like this regenerative investment concept and looking at kind of impact investment that is going to support this movement further. And so I'm hopeful.
I think that's what we need. Absolutely, we need hope and potential. And I know California is living it in real time. And boy, I think we would look back in our own history. You can look at it, until the Dust Bowl actually hit D.C., literally hit D.C.,
right.
That's when things actually drastically happened. So maybe Mar-a-Lago, we should all go down there and bring our own natural catastrophe down to Florida. Who knows? Something like that. Surround him in a moat of ecological despair. And I'm sorry to give you, it's interesting because I give you a statement. It sounds like it was maybe a little older, but I get that often too. People say, hey, you remember when you said this? And I remember saying, I said that? I don't remember saying, oh, yes, but that's exactly right. There you go. So yeah. Good response to this. Hey,
it's still true, though.
Very
it's
much.
Interesting because, I mean, I did write it a few, couple years ago, but it is still true. And I feel like, you know, I've worked in this realm. I've kind of gotten myself a little pigeonholed in this certification kind of corner, but it doesn't, I don't want it to detract from what I'm doing in a way. Like I feel like it's a way for really amazing farmers to be recognized for their hard work and to, you know, that labels are necessary and third party certification is necessary because we don't tend to know our farmers. And I mean, certainly in an ideal world, we all know our farmers and we support our local farming communities. And that's where we go to buy our food. And we don't really need it perhaps at that point, but we're a long ways out from that. And so in the meantime, you know, busy moms and dads, they're running through the store. They're trying to navigate the sea of labels. They're trying to figure out, oh my gosh, what does this one mean? And what does that one mean? And I definitely get it. I understand there's this proliferation of labels and competition among labels. And you have to be a really savvy consumer, and that's where the millennials and the Generation Z step in with their smartphones and as they swipe their way through the market and figure out what they want to buy because they want to look behind the curtain. They want to know how that food is produced, and they're demanding transparency. And so, you know, I think that that's going to take us a long ways into building this movement.
And as we are both parents of teenagers, whew, man. They live that in those mobile phones, and they can get access to that information in split seconds. It's impressive. So, Elizabeth, what can we expect to see from the Regenerative Organic Association in coming months and in coming years?
Okay. Well, right now we are just working on the onboarding process for the different certification bodies who are going to have us train their auditors and their reviewers to begin to do the audits. And so we're right at the kind of entering into the active stage of our pilot. Our pilot project includes 21 participants from 9 different countries. And so we have a really diverse representation of brands and farms and ranches, and they're growing different crops and different types of livestock. And we've got dairy, fruits, vegetables, wine, grains, meat, cotton, legumes and medicinal herbs represented in our pilot. And we also range from size from like just a few acres to 1,000+ acres. So we're going to get out and do these audits. And my goal is to begin the audits as soon as we can and try to wrap them up by end of June or July. And then we'll have some time to really, I mean, all along the way, we're going to be gathering the feedback and looking, you know, just gathering the feedback from the pilot participants themselves, from the farmers, and then from the certification bodies and their auditors to refine our guidelines, improve the certification and audit process. So we'll be working on that. And at that time, my ROA board is going to be on call, on notice that June, July, and August are going to be very busy. So we're going to need to make changes because I need to have this framework ready to go. And then I want to open the door for general certification by September. And that's so that we can try and at least get part of the harvest season from this year. You know, many places will still be harvesting. So we'll have September till the end of the year and just launch into certification. And then we're going to grow. And I can tell you by the number of folks who I have waiting at the door, like, when can we submit our application, that we're going to be really busy. And we'll start onboarding other certification bodies, I'm sure. Right now we have a pretty diverse group and really tried to target the agencies that had competency in multiple scopes or multiple pillars. Hmm. So, you know, at minimum they had to do USDA organic in most cases. Or EU organic, and then at least one of the animal welfare and or social competency so that we could make sure that they have auditors who have the kind of competency that we need.
Hmm. Fantastic. And is the best place for our listening audience to learn more about what you're up to at your website?
Yeah. Yeah, and just you could sign up for the mailing list. We don't send a lot of mailings out, just probably once every, 4 or 5 weeks. And I hope you like my use of the royal we. But I do have some great help with the communications, and so we've been getting out more and more communications with my colleague Nicole Markoff, who's been doing a great job, and she's been helping a lot. And we're going to be sending out pretty regular communications about how things are going with the pilot, and also you can see where we're going to be, different events and trade shows. Next week we'll be at Expo West, and there's a lot of events happening at Expo West around regenerative. There's a whole climate day next Tuesday, and really excited that Yvon Chouinard is going to basically be keynoting at that. He doesn't get out to speak that often. And so, yeah, I'm thrilled that he's going to be there. Rose Macario, also incredible, and are just a regen warrior. She's got a panel at Expo. We've got one where we're featuring 6 of our pilot participants, and they're coming from all around the world. We have someone from Ghana, we've got Nicaragua, Northern California, Southern California, South Dakota. The Audubon's Conservation Ranching Program is sending their main person from Marshall from up there in the Dakotas. And then we've got the Herb Farm from Oregon represented. So I'm really excited about the panel, and those folks are going to come and share some of the challenges and successes they've had in getting ready for this rock audit process.
Great diversity for promoting biodiversity. So
that's right.
I'll just close by saying the Regenerative Organic Alliance is defining solutions of change, which are truly now aspirational, but will soon be a new baseline in food and probably a new baseline in circular economies. That is an exciting evolution. That is hope and potential for us all, and that gives me excitement as well. So, Elizabeth Whitlow, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to partake in a conversation. I learned a great deal. I know our listening audience will. So thanks.
Thank you for having me and for all your good work. I really look forward to your shows and just still amazed how you're able to pull it off, do such good work on top of all your other ventures. And so I thank you deeply for that good work in this world.
Well, thank you. I'm blushing, so thanks.
Excellent. All right.
Take care.
I will see you somewhere along the way here, along this path.